begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Hello, and thank you for listening to the second part of our two-part series on Orson Welles. I'm your host, Lady P, no relation to Master P. And cruising up to the mic on his horseless carriage is film historian, writer, and Welles scholar, Professor Joseph McBride. Welcome back to FlixWise, Joe.
Always good to be back with you.
Joe has had a very busy year. First, he published his long-awaited critical study of the works of Ernst Lubitsch. We talked about that on a previous episode. Then the Welles film he's been championing for some 40-plus years, The Other Side of the Wind, was released on Netflix. And you guessed it, we did a podcast on that. And now the third of Joe's recent projects has finally come out. Criterion recently put out a Blu-ray of Welles' 1942 feature, The Magnificent Ambersons, which features an interview by the one and only Joseph McBride. So we're going to devote this entire show to Welles' mutilated masterpiece, which I understand doesn't narrow it down that much, but it is the most famous, perhaps, of his mutilated masterpiece. We can talk about that. And while we're at it, we might as well assess whether it's worthy of the 81st spot on the Sight and Sound list. Okay, so for this episode, I'm going to assume that listeners have all seen the film and are somewhat familiar with the plot. But in case, here we go. The Magnificent Ambersons was adapted from the Booth Tarkington novel of the same name. It features performances by several Mercury Theater mainstays, including Joseph Cotten as Eugene Morgan and Agnes Moorehead as Fanny Minifer. The film is set in turn-of-the-century Indianapolis, Indiana, where the Amberson name rules supreme. They are the wealthiest, most influential family in town. That is, until the Industrial Revolution begins to unravel their way of life and their position within the community starts to recede. Tim Holt plays George Amberson, the last Amberson will have any firsthand account of the family's former greatness. And the film follows as he slowly comes to terms with his diminished stature and learns to make do with what remains of his legacy. We'll get into the story of the film's production, which is as storied as any Welles production. But in short, there were elements of the film that were reshot, namely the ending, which in Welles' version was sort of more melancholy, and in the release version plays as much more upbeat. It plays as, it's kind of a happier ending. Nevertheless, the film seems to have endured, and you know, people still find so much to love about it. And we'll talk about why, what it is about this film that proves timeless, despite its period setting and everything else. So, but first, let's start with how we like the film. This always feels like a very silly question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Joe, do you like Magnificent Ambersons?
Well, it's my favorite movie of all time.
Sure, of course, yeah. So you'd say you'd like it.
I put it number one on the Sight and Sound list myself, but
nice. Okay,
it's hard to pick. You know, I mean, Welles made several great masterpieces, and there's so many great films. But why one loves a film is personal to some extent, and I've been mulling that over for a long time. Part of it is that I'm from the Midwest, and you live in the Midwest, and Welles captures the ambiance of what we call flyover country, disparagingly in America. And, but the Midwest has produced a lot of great literature and, an occasional great movie. And this captures much of the feeling, I think, of the nouveau riche and then the collapse of these great fortunes and, the coming of, industrialization, as you mentioned, and how that changed everything. And it's a metaphor also for how America changed. It's an epic film, as Welles said.
Sure. Yeah. So when did you first see it and what was your reaction at the time?
I was in a little room in the student union in Madison when I was a student and saw it on 16 millimeter, and I was blown away by it, especially the first half hour. I thought it was the best film footage I've ever seen. And I still think it is. It's just magical. It's unlike any other film. As James Agee wrote in his review at the time, it's shot from a viewpoint so fresh that it creates a visual suspense in the very act of its unfolding, which I thought was a great way of explaining it. Welles had a vision like nobody else. And he's the book won a Pulitzer Prize. It's a beautifully written book, and it starts with a long kind of portrait of this town and gradually gets to the family that it's about. And so Wells does a similar thing. He condenses it a lot, but he tells you about the town, and then he kind of zeroes in on the people and shows you the town and their mores and puts you in that period. And he loved the past, as Max Ophuls' character, the MC in Le Ron, says, I adore the past. It's more certain than the future and more restful than the present.
Sure, yeah.
Wells idealized this Lost Eden, as he often called it, and he said the two films of his that were most personal to him were Chimes of Midnight and Amberson's. Chimes of Midnight is based on Shakespeare's plays about Prince Hal becoming a king, and it's about what they called Merry Old England, and Wells said Merry Old England never really existed, and the Amberson's era never really was as wonderful as it's portrayed, but it's the idea of that Lost Eden is what counts for Wells, and he thought that was part of the human condition, that we all mourn for our lost past or lost Edens.
Sure, yeah. No, I mean, nostalgia is certainly something inherent to being alive and being a human, right? We all have fondness for things that we haven't personally experienced for some reason. Very relatable.
I've noticed that we tend to be nostalgic for the period right before we were born, the period we didn't experience our parents' generation, which is, you know, I was born right after World War II, and I am nostalgic for World War II. I mean, a horrible time, but
right.
I wish I had lived then to experience that, so I'm fascinated when I read about it and watch films about it. And I'm nostalgic for the 1950s when I grew up, even though there was a kind of an awful time in America in a lot of ways for women and minorities. And I was having a rough childhood, and I often wonder, why am I nostalgic for that terrible time? But I am. You know, it's peculiar. Right. I think we kind of recreate history in our minds, but Amberson's, the more I think about it, I know it's a very dark story, but I realize what it's about is about a boy killing his mother, actually.
And in many ways, yeah. I mean, it's interesting, you know, it is about this lost Eden, but Wells seems to undercut it a bit with this use of a kind of ironic voiceover. And I'm wondering what you make of the use of voiceover in the film. Obviously, Wells doesn't actually perform in the film. He doesn't there's no corporeal presence, but his voice appears.
Yeah, he's in it as a character, in a sense, by being the narrator. And
exactly.
The audience at the time was familiar with that from his radio series. He had his first-person singular series, as they called it, for a while, then the Mercury Theater on the Air. And he did the Ambersons as a radio show. And I hosted a series for 2 months in the 70s called Working with Wells for the American Film Institute. And Richard Wilson, who was his assistant on Amberson's and other films, and I did an interesting experiment. We did a whole evening on the radio. And Amberson's had been done as a radio play. And so we thought, hey, let's take the first 10 minutes of the film and remove the soundtrack and play the radio show and see how it works. And it was it synced up perfectly almost. Mm. So much radio influence. And the way Wells got to make this film was he played the radio recording for George Schaefer, the head of production at RKO. And unfortunately, Schaefer fell asleep while he was listening to it, which might have been a sign of things to come. But Schaefer said, yeah, go ahead and make this film. And it was fraught with some danger. When you look back in retrospect, it sounded like a great project. You know, Hollywood made those kinds of family sagas and, grand stories about grand families. And that's what RKO expected, I suppose, was something more conventional. And instead, they got this extremely dark film, which attacked the automobile as ruining America, a metaphor for industrialization. And, you know, a lot of what was happening in America in the 1900s was the transition from an agrarian society to an urban society. And that had a lot to do with the Industrial Revolution and the migration of people from the country to the city. And that's a theme. You see that in a lot of Frank Capra films and a lot of other films. That's a theme in a lot of literature. And Sinclair Lewis explores Midwestern life rather scathingly in his books. And Willa Cather, another great Midwestern novelist, deals with frontier life. And so Wells was dealing with a very deep, serious theme, and he dealt with it in a very challenging way. And as Robert Wise, the editor of the film, told me, if the film had come out a year earlier, it might have done pretty well. But it had the misfortune of being in production when Pearl Harbor took place on December 7, 1941. The next day they were shooting the scene in the auto factory. That morning, everybody was in a state of shock. And so the film was finished and released in June of 42, when the country was still reeling from, you know, we had 6 months of terrible military defeats, and the whole country was geared up for war. They went onto war footing. Factories turned into war plants 24 hours a day. Women were pressed into service, went to work, and the whole country was devoted to building tanks and jeeps and trucks and everything. And so here's a film that comes out and says the automobile ruins America. It seems subversive in that context. And it actually is subversive. I mean, Wells was a subversive filmmaker. And it was like the worst possible time to release this.
Sure.
And couple that with what was happening in Wells's career, it was kind of a disaster. But one thing I found that is surprising, everybody assumes that this film was a flop. So when I was on Variety, I went into the Variety files and I looked at, Variety used to run weekly reports on the box office in major cities. It was sort of a spotty way of checking how a film was doing, but it was interesting. And actually, Ambersons had a pretty good opening. I found, I was surprised, contrary to the myth. So much of film history is untrue. It opened well in certain cities, like San Francisco had a sensational first week, $25,000 the first week, which was huge, and then $15,000 the second week, which was very good. And some cities not so good. Chicago, for some reason, not so good, but other cities it did very well. Some cities did pretty well. It showed that it had some potential at the box office, and RKO abruptly yanked it after 2 weeks, which was very telling. I think they deliberately killed the film. But even before that, when they released it, it was released on a double bill, as films were in those days, with a film called Mexican Spitfire Sees a Ghost.
Right, I can see the thematic parallels.
Yeah, one of the worst double bills you could imagine. You know, it's kind of, you know, we don't believe in this film.
Right.
So the audience, to give them their due, if they had let the film play for a month or so, as was more common back then, it might have done pretty well. But it was a fairly expensive film, not wildly expensive. It was $1.1 million, but the sets, you know, big sets, expensive. And so it was on the books as a money loser.
Yeah. Such a shame. You mentioned, you know, that it is sort of deeply ambivalent about industrialization and the changing times. But it's also not a polemical work, right? Like the ethical, the moral center of the film is presumably, you may disagree, but I think it's Eugene Morgan, who's the Joseph Cotton character, and he's the inventor of the horseless carriage.
Yeah.
And he laments the change as much as anyone. But yeah, so what do you think? What do you think Wells's take on it was? Is he as ambivalent as the film seemed to suggest?
I don't think he's ambivalent. I think he's totally against industrialization in the modern world. He didn't like the modern world. He liked the Middle Ages. Actually, he said that. Mm. That's one reason he likes Spain, is that it's kind of behind the times. Mm. But when you see the Roger Ryan, who is a Wells aficionado, a friend of mine who lives in Michigan, who makes videos for a living, and he did an experiment in the 90s where he put together his reconstruction of Ambersons using stills from the missing scenes, because RKO cut 50 minutes out of the film and reshot parts of it and reshuffled scenes. But we have the dialogue transcription, which the studio made, so we know what the dialogue was and what the shots were supposed to be. So Roger got himself and his wife and some friends, amateur actors, to do the voices, and they do the voices over the stills. And then he got some of the missing music by Bernard Herrmann, which RKO cut out some of Herrmann's great music, but it was released on a recording later, and Herrmann took his name off the film. So Roger put together his own fan recreation, which is wonderful, actually, and it's amateurish, but Wells always thought amateurishness was good because it comes from the word amo, for love. And I like the fact that the actors don't try to imitate Joseph Cotten or Agnes Moorehead or whatever. That would have been awful. It throws the emphasis on the meaning of the words. And so it's a very different film. It's kind of shocking, actually. When I teach Wells, what I do is I show the release version, and then the following week I show Roger's version, which is about, I think 15 minutes longer, something like that. And it's a radically different film. It is kind of polemical in the sense that it basically says the automobile just polluted the atmosphere. It's one thing that's way ahead of its time. It deals with environmental pollution. I mean, who was talking about that in 1942? And it's about how the gasoline engine polluted the air and darkened the skies and caused soot to go over the houses and the laundry in the backyards. People used to hang their laundry in the backyards, and how the whole economy of the town was altered by this in a bad way, and the inner cities decayed and like they are today, and turned into slums, and the old grand houses were torn down or turned into apartment houses, or, you know, all these economic changes Tarkington documents in the book. So it's really an attack on what happened to America, and Wells is mourning that in the film, and that's one thing I find very powerful. And he parallels that with this tragic family story about this spoiled rich young man who ruins the life of his mother. But when you say ambivalence, okay, I see your point that Wells, one of the great things about him as an artist was that he could condemn what somebody did but not the person. In other words, you could see the differences and you could see the social pressures on people. And he was a student of human nature. And for example, he said in Othello, jealousy is hateful, but Othello is not hateful. So Eugene Morgan, who helps invent the automobile, is a very sympathetic figure in the film, very civilized, very genteel. Joseph Cotten, very charming actor. And he has a great speech where he talks about how the automobile is going to change everything about society and how it's not good, but, you know, it's going to come whether we want it or not. And he's part of that, and he realizes he's part of this, but he almost feels powerless to do anything about it. And we all kind of feel that way in some way about social change. There are huge economic events and world events that we try to influence and struggle to influence, and we don't always succeed. And So we don't condemn in Wells' films the person who would be the villain in the lesser director's films. Even Citizen Kane, Charles Foster Kane, does many hateful things, but you kind of like the guy, and he's kind of a sympathetic figure, and that's part of what makes Wells' films so fascinating. And Tim Holt, I think, is great as George Amberson Minifer, and a lot of the focus of people's anger about this film. I used to show this film or see it in theaters in the 60s, and it was really appalling the reaction this film got, and I can imagine how it had the same reaction in 1942 from some people. For one thing, Aunt Fanny, Agnes Moorehead, gives one of the greatest performances in film history as spinster, as we used to call them, Aunt Fanny, who's sexually frustrated and very mocked and mistreated and taken for granted, so she's full of anger and lashing out at people, and people used to laugh at her in theaters, and I would get so angry at this. I one time shouted at people at the Clark Theater in Chicago to shut up.
Good for you.
Yeah. Jerks. Back then. And I kind of stunned them into silence. One guy gave me a really dirty look on the way out, but I noticed when the feminist movement came in the early 70s, suddenly overnight, nobody laughed at Aunt Fanny. It was like almost overnight.
Yeah.
Suddenly they realized this is not a figure of fun. This woman is a tragic character we should feel empathy for. And yeah. George, people have trouble with him because he's not a likable character in many ways. He does terrible things to his mother. He's selfish. He's arrogant. He's full of entitlement, and he ruins his mother's life by sabotaging her romantic relationship with Eugene Morgan, which she's fully entitled to have a relationship with him after she becomes a widow. But George can't stand that because he's got this Oedipal problem, you know, with his mother.
Right.
And he behaves in the most atrocious way. And yet, I think Holt is so good. You kind of care for this guy, even though he's so awful.
First time I saw it, I didn't quite register what Holt was doing. And this time, after having rewatched it, I really appreciate how, you know, he doesn't really telegraph anything. Like, he lets George be kind of awful. And at the same time, you are sympathetic. And, I mean, it's not, he doesn't emote particularly. Like, you could see how he might get accused of being kind of wooden. But I think it's really effective. Like, he really embodies this sort of man-child creation, you know, like we're all very familiar with this guy, you know, and you see this child at the beginning, and then you could very easily see how that child would become Tim Holt, you know. And it's so interesting because Tim Holt has in later in his career would play much more likable characters, you know.
Yeah, he's in four great films: Stagecoach, Ambersons, My Darling Clementine, and The Treasure of the Sierra Madre. And in Sierra Madre, he plays a very likable character. So Wells thought he was a wonderful actor he said he made the wise decision to be in B-movies, Westerns, because it was a steady way of life and less stressful than trying to be a star in major films. And he was always good, and he never got the credit he was due. And a lot of times people look at Ambersons and they think, well, Tim Holt is a bad actor because they confuse the actor and the part. This is a typical problem people have with criticism. If somebody's an unlikable character, they think, well, the actor must be a bad actor. And but I think Tim Holt, part of it is Lucy is in love with him, and Baxter, and Eugene Morgan is fond of him. And, you know, why would they be fond of him if he were just a hateful schmuck, you know?
Sure.
He's got some charm, and he's got some boyish qualities, as you say. They kind of feel he's funny and he's kind of silly and sad. I'd like to write a whole essay just on Tim Holt and why he's so good in this film. And one thing you could do is they did a ghastly remake of this film for television a few years ago, and the actor who played him, whose name I keep suppressing. And,
oh, is it Jonathan Rhys-Meyers?
Yeah, right. I keep trying to block that name out. He is so odious in that role. He's like a monster in a melodrama, that you can't imagine somebody want to be in the same room with this guy for a minute. And whereas Tim Holt, you could imagine being kind of drawn into him despite his bad qualities. And that's part of what is so good about Wells and what's so good about Tim Holt is that you can see this seduction. As Truffaut said, Wells shows the fragility of the monster, or the humanity behind the powerful man, the weakness of the powerful. That's Wells' theme. And so Wells felt this was a very autobiographical film for him because Wells' father actually was a friend of Booth Tarkington. This has been documented. Wells' father was a playboy industrialist from Wisconsin, spent a lot of time in Chicago, chasing showgirls and having a good time, and Tarkington was part of its circle. Tarkington was a great Indiana writer, and so Wells felt that Eugene Morgan was partly drawn from his father, and that evidently was true. Mm. His father, as Wells said in a wonderful phrase, he said he tried very hard to invent the automobile.
Mm.
Yeah, he had some patents. He had a brass fixtures factory in Kenosha, Wisconsin, where they built automobile lamps. They were bicycle lamps, and then they made a fortune by converting them to automobile lamps. That's as far as he got in inventing the automobile. He also tried to invent the airplane, but didn't succeed. But he was trying. He was one of those kind of guys. And he was a man about town. And so when you think about it, Wells could be George. And George Wells's actual name was George Orson Welles, oddly enough. And Welles was kind of like that. He was this diabolical, spoiled, rich kid, you know. And he wrote a play called Bright Lucifer when he was a young man that was finally produced in Madison a few years ago, in which he, it's about a young man who's kind of a monstrous, devilish character they all find really compelling, but kind of scary. And that's kind of like George and Emerson. So there's a lot of Wells's family feeling in it. But I think actually after examining this film for decades, I think the deepest reason he made this film is he felt he had killed his father. He wrote this in Vogue magazine in 1982, a rather shocking part of his autobiography. He wrote little portraits of his mother and father, who both died in his youth. And his father was an alcoholic, and he was persuaded, he said, by the Roger Hill and Hortense Hill, his kind of guardians at boarding school, to stop seeing his father because he wouldn't stop drinking and he was causing a lot of trouble. And this is what we now call tough love. And so Wells stopped seeing his father, and then his father drank himself to death in a hotel room. Wells claimed his father committed suicide. The death certificate says he died of a heart disease and a kidney disease, but Wells literally thought he'd killed his father. And he said, I don't think we should, he said, I hate psychoanalysis because I don't think we should get over our guilt. He said we should live with it. And that I think is the animating theme of his entire body of work, is this one man betraying another theme, and the guilt and the destruction that causes. And so I think he wasn't quite ready to deal with that. He deals with it directly in Chimes of Midnight. That's one reason it's a great film. It's about Hal betraying his father figure, Falstaff. He has another father figure who's his actual father. But in Amberson's, what he transposes that to is the young man killing his mother. And in Kane, the mother sells her son to a bank, I mean, which is incredibly shocking. And when I say that to people, they think, oh, no, that isn't true. But if you look at the film, that's what she does.
Yeah.
So he's dealing with some of the most primal, horrible things families can do to each other. It's like the Greek tragedies, you know, where people killing their children or killing their parents, or, you know. So I think that's one reason Amberson's is so troubling, and one reason I like it, frankly.
Wells was never one to shy away from big themes, right? So there's a lot. There's like a lot of socio-political ramifications of the. There's a lot of subtext there, but then there's also. I mean, you're right that George sets in motion events that ultimately lead to his mother's death.
Yeah.
I think, as far as how this film is received, you know, I can see how viewers at the time might not have known exactly what to do with this film. You know, I've seen it a handful of times, and it gets better with each viewing. I find it just gets richer and richer.
Yeah, I like to quote François Truffaut, who wrote in 1972, he said it was a mutilated masterpiece. He said it hasn't had the repercussions of Citizen Kane. And in any theater today, moreover, there will be half as many spectators for Amberson's. Yet each time I see this film, it has a far greater emotional effect on me. I believe that in shooting Citizen Kane, Orson Welles was more anxious about the medium, while in Amberson's, he seems to have been excited primarily by the characters. Mm. Welles says it was a much better picture than Kane if they had just left it as it was. It is true that he's focus more on the characters. You're not noticing the camera as much, perhaps, although it's very virtuosic. The camera work is astounding, and the editing and the narrative style is very audacious. The way he encompasses giant jumps in time and different points of view, and the photography is stunning, you know, with its recreation of a period look with the kind of soft focus around the edges, like old photographs at first. And the ballroom sequence, Wells said, was the greatest tour de force of his career. Tremendous deep focus photography. Stanley Cortez shot a lot of it, and he was a great cameraman in some ways. He shot The Night of the Hunter, which is one of the great masterpieces of cinematography. But I kind of resented the fact that, like, I knew Cortez, and he never would admit the fact that he got fired from Amberson's. You covered that up. But Wells told me that he fired Cortez, he was slow. He was a B picture cameraman. He took on because he liked his work and he thought he could work fast. And Cortez started taking his time. He was very pretentious, and he would say things like, Orson, doesn't this shot remind you of Respighi's Fountains of Rome? Or, Orson, I see this shot as Rembrandt's An Old Man Seated. Wells hated that kind of pretentious comparing film to other art forms, but that was how Cortez thought. So he was getting great pressure from RKO because Kane had not done well at the box office for a lot of reasons that, you know, we could go into, but we won't. But so RKO was getting nervous. The film was starting to go over schedule. And then when Pearl Harbor took place, there was great pressure to wrap it up. And so he fired Cortez, he told me. One day he said he got a telegram from some cinematographer's group. They were giving an award to Cortez, and they wanted him to come and give it. And he laughed. He said, this is the only cameraman I ever fired. Although he fired a few on Othello, actually. But what he said was Cortez came to him in tears and begged to be allowed to stay on the film. And so Wells gave him his own unit where he would be on another stage setting up scenes for hours. And then when he was ready to shoot, Wells would run over and do the scene while he was working mostly with Harry J. Wilde and Russell Meddy, who shot, you know, a great part of the film.
Interesting.
But it looks great. It looks great. And the use of the moving camera is fantastic. I mean, Wells didn't have the access to Hollywood crane shots again until Touch of Evil. He said there is no pleasure in the world like working with a Hollywood crew.
Unions, it was a thing.
Great. But in those days, the crane weighed 2,000 pounds and took 10 men to push it, you know. And so when you see these flowing camera shots in Amberson's, I and other film buffs like you, you know, we're thrilled because we know what it took to do those scenes. Today you could do them more easily with a Steadicam, and it's not as hard to do. But back then it was a challenge, and Max Ophuls and Wells did it better than anyone else. And so when you see these shots, it's breathtaking in the length and duration of the shots. Wells had a shot in Amberson's The Ballroom Scene that went on for minutes, and the RKO cut into the middle of it because the audience laughed at some funny business in the middle, which was supposed to be funny, you know. And he said they ruined, like, the best shot he ever did up to that point.
Ah,
you know, but
man,
there's enough of it in there. When, you know, somebody said to me once, you know, how can you say this is your favorite film when you keep talking about how they ruined it? That's a really good question. And I thought about that, and I don't have a complete answer to that. Part of it is I love a film maudit, as the French call it, a damned film. I have a soft spot in my heart for the underdog, being a kid who was abused and bullied. You know, I always take the viewpoint of the underdog. And so when people are beating up on a film, I'm always defending it. And this film was treated as badly as almost any film, except maybe Eric von Stroheim's Greed. But Peter Bogdanovich said what happened to Amberson's was the greatest artistic tragedy in the history of films. So that's part of it, is an emotional thing, but it's also, I love the film for reasons I've mentioned, the Midwestern background, the psychological themes that are, you know, I can relate to some of the family issues, and I love the visuals, and I love the acting, and I love the characters, and, you know, there's so much love about the film that it overrides the fact that it's hardly a shell of what it probably was the greatest film ever made before they started messing with it.
Yeah. Well, I want to get back to the damned film track, but before we do, in our previous episode, we talked a little bit about Wells's radio influence, or his radio background influenced his film work, and I'm just wondering how you see that manifesting in Amberson's. Obviously, the Wells voiceover is a major component, but just also how voices are utilized within the film to tell the story.
Well, for example, the fast history of the town that he gives in the first 10 minutes of the film is very much a radio technique. And Bernard Herrmann mentioned radio scoring, he called it, which was sound transitions that led you from one shot to another, which hadn't been used much in motion pictures at that time. But what they did on the radio was they would take these big novels, and it was kind of amazing what they did. They'd take Dracula or Les Miserables, and they would turn them into, Les Miserables was like a radio miniseries, but Dracula, they did in a 1 hour show, and it's a great show, and it's a tour de force of sound technique with multiple narrators and amazing sound effects. So they would condense these big novels, and Booth Tarkinson's novel is like that. There's a lot going on that, you know, Wells picked and chose what interested him the most, and so that's partly his radio experience of telling stories. But his presence as a narrator is very important. And to me, the most beautiful line of voiceover I've ever heard in a film is as they're introducing the ballroom sequence, he says, "It was the last of the great long-remembered dances that everybody talked about." And you can hear the quotes in his voice around the words "everybody talked about." And it's just beautiful the way he says that. It's so caressing and loving. And also there's a sense of doom surrounding everything in Wells's work. He often starts with the death of the main character or intimations of destruction. So here he's showing this great dance, and he says it's the last of the great long-remembered dances, long-remembered. So it puts it in the memory, and it's the last. Why is it the last? We were wondering, okay, what's going to happen to this family? And this is the summit of their magnificence, you know, which is sort of a sham. I mean, one thing that I didn't quite understand when I first saw the film is that the setting, the house is very grand and all, but it's really kind of a monstrosity of architecture.
Right, yeah. I remember, so Anne Baxter, who plays Lucy, is the granddaughter of Frank Lloyd Wright, right?
Yeah.
Correct?
He came on the set, and he was sitting there on the set, Wells said, and he was bad-mouthing the art direction. He would say, "Oh my God, this house is so horrible looking, and Wells was trying to explain to him, that's what we intended, you know, Mr. Wright, this is the point." And Wells said he finally got it when he saw the film, that the Ambersons are vulgar Nouveau Riche people who are, their house is over-decorated and kind of, you know, they pilfer things from Europe like Citizen Kane did, and that was considered classy in those days, but it's a sign of poor taste. That is part of the irony of the film that you have to get, and not everybody gets that. Just like they don't get that Wells has a distance from George dramatically. And so the narration, I think, helps distance the film. The irony puts it in context, both as a work of memory, the pastness of it, and a kind of ironic look at these people. The title itself is ironic, the Magnificent Ambersons, and Tarkington meant it that way. They're magnificent in their own minds and in the minds of their neighbors, but they're not magnificent in the sense of, you know, the great European families or whatever. And Wells mocks the whole idea of magnificence anyway, and riches and grandeur and human folly.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, my takeaway this time was, I don't share Orson's belief that the car is is symbolic of a major downturn in American history. I am generally one to like think that progress, including technological progress, good.
Let me ask you, because once when I showed this in class, a student made that same comment, and I just sort of said, okay. And I've regretted ever since not saying to him, okay, let's talk about that, because that's really an important question. You know, I mean, obviously we all drive cars. We all contribute to pollution. It's convenient to have a car. Wells talks in the film about how nice it was back then. They had more time because they weren't rushing around as much, and it's changed everything. But why is it that you don't like that theme? In other words,
what I will say is I appreciate that. I don't think you need to agree with him on that respect to appreciate what the film is saying about loss and about the loss that is inevitable when times change, you know, even if it is change for the better, there will still be a certain void left behind, you know, there will be those who aren't able to adapt. And I think that I appreciate that as a lament. And I don't, like I said, I don't think you need to sort of shake your fist at the coming of the automobile to understand what that means.
Like when I drive around Berkeley on stop signs, people spray paint under the word stop, they spray paint watching television.
Sure.
Which I think is stupid. You know, I mean, like, stop.
Yeah, I love television.
I saved my life when I was a kid, you know.
Yeah.
But you could say there are some bad things about television that have polluted our world and hurt the movie business and all kinds of things. But there's some good things. And I think that's a very good perspective. And that reminds me of Ozu's perspective on the world. He dealt with change constantly. That's his, one of his big themes, is the change in the Japanese family and society, that, you know, no longer were they revering old people and families were breaking up and the attitudes toward marriage were changing and all these things were, you could lament certain qualities that were being lost, but they're inevitable. And Ozu was mature enough, he understood that, you know, you have to accept certain changes in life. And as Eugene says in Amberson's, the automobile is going to come whether we like it or not, but all outward things are going to be changed, and that's, we're going to see changes in men's minds as a result of it, you know?
Right.
So the real complexity, I think, is to understand these changes that are inevitable. We're destroying our planet, though. I mean, with the air pollution and other things that we're doing. The opening of Dr. Strangelove, if you find the original script, it starts with a dead planet, which is Earth, of course. Mm. And these aliens land, and they wonder, how could people be so stupid as to destroy their own planet? And, you know, what kind of idiots were these people? And they find one can of film, that's all that's left, and they open it and says Dr. Strangelove, and they say, oh, let's put this on and see what kind of people they were, you know. And Amberson's is kind of like that in a way. I mean, Wells had a certain apocalyptic vision like Kubrick did, and it, you know, certainly is true, and we're just making it worse every day instead of trying to make it better. I mean, I just keep reading that we have 10 or 12 years left as a species to reverse this trend before it's too late.
Yeah, it's pretty horrifying.
Kind of, they're the canaries in the coal mine who are warning us that, geez, we love our cars, but, you know, what's the cost?
Sure, yeah.
It's not just cars, but it's the whole industrial way of life and machinery. And, you know, I just sat through an interesting seminar on digital media, and there was a lot of debate in film studies or digital studies about, are we governed by machines, or can we use machines to help us think and not tell us what to think? And, you know, I mean, we're evolving a lot technologically, and we're trying to keep up with the meaning of that. And Wells was trying to deal with that in this film. It's a metaphor for all kinds of things.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it's still so resonant. We are still, as you say, dealing with the repercussions of these changes. And I could see how folks at the time might not have appreciated, at least a good portion of the country, how that might not appeal to them.
Well, at the worst time, because, you know, the whole country, as Gore Vidal says, we were a totalitarian society at that time because we had to be. To fight a world war, the whole country was mobilized, you know. And so there's a film that is, as the New York Times review said, you know, Wells expects us to feel bad about the troubles of a few minor league American aristocracy in the late 19th century. I was expecting too much of the audience in 1942, but as I've written, this is not a film for 1942. It's a film for the ages, you know.
Right. So back to this notion of the damned film. You know, I kind of think that the film status as a mutilated masterpiece has bolstered its status in many ways. Like, it becomes this treasure, like this, like the finished work, it forever remains in people's minds as this kind of question mark, or like it allows them to kind of fill in the blank, like, what would this have looked like had it not been messed with? And maybe ultimately, you know, maybe ultimately it wouldn't have been changed all that much. We don't know.
Well, we do
for certain.
You can read the Cutting Continuity and book, and you know what Wells intended. We don't have all the shots. Roger Ryan has been trying to find all. I actually saw the final shot of the film, which has since disappeared, sadly enough.
Peter
showed me a bunch of frame enlargements in 1970, including the last shot. So I think he and I, and maybe Oya Kodar, are the only living people who've actually seen the last shot of Amberson's, which is At the end of the film, Eugene goes to Fanny's boarding house. She's living in a shabby boarding house, and he says it's the end of communication between people. That's what Wells said. It's the death of everything. And
sure.
Really have anything to talk about anymore. It's very sad. And then he leaves in his fancy car and drives away. And it's a long shot overhead angle of this polluted city with a lot of smoke hanging over it and an elevated train in the background, a very elaborate composite shot. You see factories, you see this tiny automobile driving around the corner. And in the Criterion video I did, I did a drawing from memory of this shot, which Peter had these frame enlargements that were made for Wells' use at the time, and Wells had loaned them to him, and then he gave them back to Wells. And then apparently Oya Kodar, I tried tracing these because this one couldn't be found, she put them in a storage facility under a freeway in L.A., and her nephew and his friends stored their surfboards in there, and they left the door unlocked one time, and somebody stole the stuff.
Oh, no.
So the last shot was stolen. So we have missing footage and missing shots, but Roger has found a lot of frame enlargements of the missing scenes. You see some of them in the video I did for Criterion, and we talk about the changes in the film. So we do have a sense of what it was like, but yeah, it's not the same as seeing the actual film.
Though. Right. And I mean, my point is, like, we don't know. It allows us to use our imaginations in some ways, and I think that's to the film's benefit, and it adds to the mystique of the film.
Yeah,
I think
you're right that it. Renoir said that film should be interactive, and I guess that's an interesting way to look at it. We collaborate with, you know, as somebody said, well, the ending is horrendous, but it's kind of like a dramatic demonstration of how different Hollywood's sensibility was from Wells' sensibility in 1942, that this feel-good, happy ending is tacked on. It's so grotesque. And he wanted this very dark ending. It was a very Chekhovian film, and it's like Chekhov's The Cherry Orchard, and that was it's not the sensibility of the mass audience at the time. But one of my goals in life, and I'm getting old, but move on to wherever I go. I intend fully to go to Brazil to try to find the missing Ambersons. And I keep saying this because the more I say it, the more I have to do it. It's a perhaps futile quest, but there is some thought that Wells may have left a print of the film behind because he had a print down there. They had a 131-minute version that he was working on, and Robert Wise was supposed to go down there to help him do the final edit, and then RKO reneged on that. They blamed the war. They claimed they couldn't get Wise on a plane, but then they ignored Wells's editing suggestions. But what happened to those 31 cans of nitrate film and audio, including some additional scenes that they weren't sure whether they're going to put in or not? There is some thought that Wells may have left them with a Brazilian film buff who owned a film laboratory down there. You know, I really regret not asking him about that. It was a sensitive subject, and we talked about Ambersons a little, but not much. But what happened to that footage? It would have been hard to bring it back because he came back to Hollywood in three different airplanes, small planes. It would have been impossible to carry 31 cans of nitrate film. But it may still exist on there. There are some indications that the footage was not destroyed, and stranger things have happened. You know, like they found a complete print of Metropolis down in South America a few years ago, 30 minutes longer than the version we had. And the director's cut of The Passion of Joan of Arc turned up in a Danish mental hospital.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Too Much Johnson, getting closer to home. Wells's lost early film, Too Much Johnson, turned up.
Yeah.
A warehouse in Italy. I mean, who would have thought that could happen?
Exactly. One never knows. Okay, well, I think that's about a good place to stop. But before we cut out, I just have to ask the obligatory canon question. This film is currently the 81st movie on the Sight and Sound Critics Poll. Is it worthy of that spot?
Well, I think it's worthy of being in the top 10, but again, it's arbitrary and people have their own, you know, this is partly popularity contest, but it is, Wells made several great films, you know, Kane, Ambersons, Touch of Evil, Chimes of Midnight, right up there. Anybody who wants to learn more about why the film was mutilated and how it was mutilated and how RKO double-crossed Wells and lied to him and destroyed his Hollywood career can watch the Criterion video. By the way, I go into that in detail. But I think Amberson's is highly revered, as you say. And you make a great point that its mutilated status makes us kind of love the film. It's a, what could have been, as Whittier wrote, the saddest words of tongue and pen are what could have been. But I also think of Wordsworth's lines about splendor in the grass, glory in the flower, rather than look back at what's lost, look at what remains behind. And what we have is 88 minutes of a lot of great Wells footage. He says after about 30 minutes, it becomes their film. But the first 30 minutes is pretty much intact, and it's his film, and it's a masterpiece. And then there's some great scenes after that. So it's one of the great works of the American cinema.
Sure, yeah. And we didn't, I mean, you mentioned Agnes Moorehead and her performance, but that scene in the kitchen is devastating.
Yeah, another thing that's lost, there's a collection of Agnes Moorehead's papers at the State Historical Society in Wisconsin. She's from Wisconsin. And I went there. She won the New York Film Critics Award for Best Actress. And she gave a speech, and somebody stole the text.
Ah.
So there's so much loss. That's part of what Amberson's is about, I think, is loss. I mean, and so the film itself is a, partly a lost object, and that's maybe why we love it.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, we're holding on to something that's, like, slipping through our fingers.
And that's what film is all about, is kind of, you know, I mean, film is a very fragile medium, and a lot of great films have been lost, and much of film history has been lost, and films burn up. The negative of Citizen Kane burned up, and, you know, we just hold on to what we can in this world, and that's what Amberson's is about.
And that's the way we frame it, flicks-wise, that is. Listeners, what do you make of the magnificent Ambersons? Come let us know on our website, flickswise.com. Or you can leave us a note on our Facebook page, facebook.com/flickswise. And if you want to talk Aggie Moorehead or Ann Baxter, you should probably come find me on Twitter. The handle is @flickswise. And if you haven't yet listened to our previous episode on Wells' recently completed film, The Other Side of the Wind, then you should probably go ahead and do that. And as for future episodes, I think we're planning on getting some Bergman in before the year is out. Plus, we'll have a couple of FlixWise Canadas, so stay tuned for that. Until then, Joe, it was a pleasure having you on, as always.
Well, thank you for your great questions, as always. It's such a pleasure talking to you about films and your passion for films. So thank you so much.
Wonderful. And I'm sure we will chat again when your next project comes out in a few months.
For sure.
All right. Take care.